look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Negotiators for President Biden and Republican congressional leaders on Saturday night reached an 11th-hour agreement in principle to raise the debt ceiling. Both sides came to a tentative agreement after weeks of delays that rattled markets and raised fears about a catastrophic default. President Biden and Kevin McCarthy had spoken by phone earlier on Saturday evening, 27th of May, after hours of marathon negotiations. In a statement, Biden said the deal protects my and congressional Democrats' key priorities and legislative accomplishments, adding that it represents a compromise, which means not everyone gets what they want. That's the responsibility of governing. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy had been at the Capitol all weekend, and he told reporters on Saturday morning that he was optimistic a deal would be reached. "I just got off the phone with the president." A while ago, McCarthy tweeted, "After he wasted time and refused to negotiate for months, we've come to an agreement in principle that is worthy of the American people." In a brief news conference following the deal, Kevin McCarthy said he expects the text of the bill to be publicly posted by Sunday, and a House vote to take place next Wednesday. He also said he would speak to President Biden again on Sunday. The exact details of the deal were not immediately clear, although CBS News learned that it would raise the debt limit for 2 years and keep non-defense spending flat at 2023 fiscal year levels for 2 years as well. Under the deal, non-defense spending would then increase by 1% in 2025 fiscal year. The deal also maintains funding for veterans' medical care programs, including the PACT Act, which was passed last year and expands benefits to 3.5 million veterans who have been exposed to toxic burn pits during wartime. According to the deal, the PACT Act's Toxic Exposure Fund will keep its funding through at least to 2025. Work requirements had been a major sticking point in the negotiations. While the deal included no drastic changes to Medicaid, it was still unclear exactly how the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF program, would be impacted. Republican House leadership informed rank-and-file GOP members of the deal in a late-night conference call, two sources familiar with the talks told CBS News. Biden administration officials were planning to hold a Zoom call with Democratic House members on Sunday evening. President Biden spoke by phone to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries just prior to the announcement of the deal. The breakthrough came just days before the government was expected to exhaust the ability to pay its bills, an unprecedented event that would send shockwaves through the global economy. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Friday pushed back the estimated deadline on the so-called X date from 1st of June to 5th of June, giving negotiators some breathing room. The risk of default remains, though, given the slim margin for error for crafting and passing the bill in Congress. Lawmakers must now transform the agreed-upon provisions into actual legislative text, a process that typically takes several days. It must then pass both chambers of Congress, overcoming expected opposition from members of both political parties. Conservatives have demanded drastic spending cuts in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, which Democrats have said should be raised without conditions. Passing the agreement in the House will likely require the votes of dozens of Democrats to offset conservative Republicans who vote against the measure. Some progressives have also vowed to oppose any bill that cuts spending too much. The House and Senate are both recessed for the Memorial Day holiday, further complicating the timeline for passing a bill. Congressional leaders have warned their respective members to be prepared to return to Washington on short notice to vote on the deal. USA Today has also covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy reached an agreement in principle on Saturday, 27th of May, to raise the nation's debt limit and cut government spending, capping a rollercoaster round of negotiations that has brought the nation to the brink of default and economic disaster. The tentative deal finalized during an hour-and-a-half phone call between President Biden and Kevin McCarthy on Saturday night would raise the limit on how much the government can borrow through to the end of 2024. In return, it would cap annual discretionary spending for 2 years, keeping non-defense spending levels flat next year and raising it by just 1% in 2025. While delivering on a host of other cuts that the Republicans had demanded. "We still have a lot of work to do," Kevin McCarthy said in a brief address from the Capitol. "But I believe this is an agreement in principle that's worthy of the American people. It has historic reductions in spending, consequential reforms that will lift people out of poverty into the workforce and reins in government overreach." Kevin McCarthy said he expects to post the text of the legislation on Sunday and hold a House vote on Wednesday. The compromise includes provisions to rescind unspent COVID-19 rescue funds, expedite permitting for energy projects by speeding up environmental reviews, and in another concession to the Republicans, roll back $10 billion of $80 billion in IRS funding approved in President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act last year that was designed to crack down on wealthy Americans and corporations that evade taxes. The deal includes no measures to close tax loopholes used by high earners and corporations. One of the final holdups was expanded work requirements for food stamps and other welfare programs, which Republicans ultimately secured despite the White House's opposition. The deal includes no changes to Medicaid, but contains additional work requirements for recipients of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF program. It would also overhaul the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, by making able-bodied adults 54 years old or younger without dependent children subject to work requirements to receive SNAP benefits. The current threshold is 49 years old. The changes, which sunset in 2030, also include expanding food stamps for veterans and the homeless. President Biden called the agreement an important step forward that reduces spending while protecting critical programs for working people and growing the economy for everyone. Despite the White House's concessions, he said the deal protects Democrats' key priorities and legislative accomplishments. "The agreement represents a compromise, which means not everyone gets what they want. That's the responsibility of governing," Biden said in a statement. He added, "The deal is good news for the American people because it prevents what could have been a catastrophic default." Biden urged Congress to pass the agreement right away. President Biden has been racing to reach a budget deal with the House Republicans to get their support for raising the debt ceiling before the U.S. government runs out of money, which the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said is on track to happen by 5th of June. Yet to avert a default, the deal still needs approval in Congress, which is not guaranteed to pass a bill to raise the debt ceiling even with the backing of both President Biden and Kevin McCarthy. Some hardline conservative Republicans in the House have signaled they won't vote for a negotiated deal on the debt ceiling, regardless of the details of the deal, while others made new 11th-hour threats for border security measures that aren't in the deal.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It's a moment that will surely be marked in history books. The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad being welcomed back to the Arab League after an 11-year absence, an absence that was forced on it due to the war in Syria by Daesh terrorists, were supported by some of the very same countries present at the summit. Now times have changed, and all countries in the region have normalized ties with Syria. The U.S. support for Daesh terrorists was not so much a quest for democracy for Syrians, as the U.S. stated, but more of an obsession to oust the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad. So for U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the rest of the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf, even Jordan, to embrace the Syrian president is surely a slap in the face of the U.S. Just like how Iran and Saudi Arabia reconciled after years of hostility, another colossal event which, according to the CIA director, the U.S. was blindsided by this major development. U.S. blindsided by Iran-Saudi rapprochement surely puts into question the weak level of U.S. intel on the ground in West Asia, but not accepting these realities just makes the U.S. isolated and detached from reality. As such, the U.S. is reacting, and true to U.S. behavior, it is doing so against international law. It has been reported that the U.S. has started to build a new military base in the northern province of Raqqa. When it comes to the U.S. illegal occupation of Syria, there are currently at least 24 U.S.-led coalition military sites spread throughout Syria's northeast. The largest base housing U.S. troops is the Al Omar Field. The oil field in Deir al-Zour province is Syria's largest and has a presence of U.S. personnel and the YPG-PKK terrorist group. Then there is the Al Tanf, also known as the Al Tanf Garrison. It is a U.S. military base, but the territory is controlled by the so-called Syrian opposition in Homs Governorate. Overall, the U.S. is occupying roughly a third, or 33%, of Syrian territory. What are U.S.'s main goals in Syria? Brett McGurk, the White House coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa, said the U.S. had four main objectives in Syria: to reduce violence, maintain military pressure on Daesh, address Syria's humanitarian crisis, and to support Israel. Except for the last goal, the U.S. has not achieved any of those stated aims. The U.S. stated goal of eradicating Daesh terrorists rings hollow. For starters, how could the U.S. not eliminate about 1,000 Daesh terrorists since the year 2016, when they first occupied Syrian soil? That is because they are using these terrorists against the Assad government, with the outdated notion of regime change. There are also reports that the U.S. trains these terrorists to use them in places like Afghanistan or other countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. is also stealing Syrian oil and selling it in the black market to provide finances for the YPG Kurdish forces and also for forces inside Iraq, since, in terms of the YPG Kurdish forces, they had supported them with the promise of partitioning an area for them in northern Syria. But the real purpose of the U.S. presence in Syria, as it has stated, to support Israel with the aim of targeting Iran, who is in Syria with the consent of the Syrian government. Both the U.S. and Israel need a wake-up call. The geopolitical shifts in the region have proven one thing: there is no need for the U.S. presence there. All countries have normalized with each other, except for maybe Yemen and Saudi Arabia, who are on course to do so. And when it comes to the security of the region, after Iran and Saudi Arabia's normalization, there is a united front that has been formed, where regional countries have stated that they will ensure their own security. There may have been a time when countries like Saudi Arabia may have sought U.S. assistance and even paid them to provide it with their security, which also included weapon sales, but those days are over. Also gone are the days when the U.S. created Iranophobia to scare regional countries into buying U.S. weapons, with the false notion that Iran was a bad actor. West Asian countries have realized that it is the U.S. and Israel who are now the bad actors in the region. This warning to the U.S. military by the commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Navy, perhaps states it best when he said, "You are damn wrong to be in our region." A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. The countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK special forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, the numbers from the US and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the, I think it's the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict the lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons' approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly now, the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq. And obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore, a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And they say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the U.S. state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates, and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson's visit to the U.S. comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the U.S. and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario, and the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion U.S. dollars in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgorod region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western Military District units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
Papua New Guinea has signed a defense and maritime cooperation agreement with the U.S. during the U.S. Pacific Islands Forum in Port Moresby. The agreement was signed by Defense Minister Win Bakridaki and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who flew into the country early on Monday in the place of U.S. President Joe Biden. In a meeting with PNG Prime Minister James Morape during the signing ceremony, Blinken said the United States would deepen its partnership across the board with the country.
The Defense Cooperation Agreement, drafted by Papua New Guinea and the United States as equal and sovereign partners, will enhance the PNG's defense forces' capabilities to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises.
Morape, for his part, hailed the deal as a mutually beneficial agreement.
Both sides have agreed that the agreement that we're signing today is doesn't offend Papua New Guinea law, doesn't offend USA law. It's mutually beneficial, especially and for me in the context of Papua New Guinea. It secures our national interest to grow into becoming a robust economy in this part of the world as we live today and going forward.
PNG's Prime Minister, James Morape, said that to implement the deal, there would be an increased presence of U.S. military personnel and contractors over the next 2 years. However, he insisted that the Americans will not establish a U.S. military base on the island. Morape also denied reports that U.S. staff would have legal immunity and said no amendments would be made to the constitution or laws of the country. That's after a leaked draft document suggested Port Moresby has given U.S. personnel and contractors legal immunity, allowing aircrafts, vehicles, and vessels operated by or on behalf of the U.S. to move freely within its territory and territorial waters, and exemptions for U.S. staff from all migration requirements. The U.S. State Department announced the new pact covers security, defense, and maritime surveillance and would provide $45 million to help improve bilateral cooperation, including protective equipment for the Papua New Guinea Defense Force. PNG, with a population of nearly 10 million people, is the most populous Pacific Island nation located just north of Australia. The region has witnessed increasing militarization in past years, raising concerns among civil society groups. They accuse Morape of setting the stage for future hostilities between the U.S. and China. PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill accused his successor of placing the country at the epicenter of a military storm between China and the U.S. by agreeing to enter into defense agreements with both superpowers without consultation with people. Also, opposition leader Joseph Lelang from the People's National Congress said last week, "We should not be blinded by the dollar sign or be coerced into signing deals that may be detrimental to us in the long run." He said the foreign policy of Papua New Guinea is friends to all and enemies to none. In the midst of growing rivalry between Washington and Beijing in the Pacific region, China has warned against geopolitical games in the South Pacific after the U.S. signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea.
What we must be vigilant about is the use of cooperation as a pretext for engaging in geopolitical games, and we believe no cooperation should target third parties.
The foreign ministry spokesperson, however, stressed that China has no objection to normal exchanges and equal, mutually beneficial cooperation with Pacific Island nations, including Papua New Guinea. She said any negotiation and cooperation agreement should benefit regional peace, development, and stability. The Pacific nations manage around 20% of the world's oceans. These hugely important maritime routes were used in World War II to transport supplies to Australia and New Zealand. Western interests in the Pacific waned after the war, but Chinese investments in the region have grown. Beijing has worked to strengthen ties with several island nations over the last decade, sending aid and investing in schools, roads, and bridges. However, in recent years, the U.S. has been expanding its military presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia. Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Gun violence is always a critical topic during U.S. elections, but experts see little hope in the U.S. political circle to address the issue due to its historical complexity and the extremely polarized stances of Democrats and Republicans, even as gun-related tragedies continue to occur in the United States of America. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more, please. Global Times noted, in the latest reflection of the miserable situation over the past week, Alabama witnessed another mass shooting tragedy in the U.S., with 4 deaths and 28 injuries, while the potential Republican presidential candidates still reportedly rejected the idea of more restrictions that could curb the bloodshed as they spoke at the annual gathering of the National Rifle Association, NRA. The Alabama shooting happened the same day that shots were fired into a crowd at a park in Louisville, Kentucky. 2 people were killed and 4 others were wounded. That incident was the city's 2nd mass shooting in less than a week. On April 10th, a gunman killed 5 people and injured several others at Louisville's Old National Bank, according to CNN. According to data released by the Gun Violence Archive, GVA, across the U.S., a total of 157 mass shootings have happened this year as of April 16th, indicating an average of 1.48 cases per day during this period. These shootings have resulted in 12,358 deaths, with 413 aged under 17 and 9,600 injuries, according to data updated recently. But former President Donald Trump still insisted that this is not a gun problem in his speech recently during NRA annual gathering. Mike Pence, Trump's vice president, also towed the line by saying that people should stop trampling on the God-given rights of the American people every time a tragedy happens, according to a New York Times report recently. Liu Xiang, research fellow at the Chinese Academy of Social, pointed out that the issue has been totally politicized and became a label of partisan conflict in the U.S. Liu told the Global Times recently, In the U.S., the Democrats have to call for banning or managing guns, while Republicans will definitely stress freedom in owning guns. It's as if they're not Democrats or Republicans if they do not stick to the party's stance. Such polarized stances have resulted in there being no space for the two parties to negotiate over the issue, which Liu deemed as the main reason why the problem of gun violence in the U.S. cannot be resolved as its root. This is a typical systematic problem of the United States, Liu noted. The Insider reported, during the NRA annual meeting, photos of children handling firearms also made the rounds on U.S. social media platforms over the weekend. Even though the association said that they had rendered the guns at the exhibitions incapable of being fired, gun control advocates slammed the scene as saying responsible gun owners and parents would not allow a child to put their finger on a firearm's trigger while pointing it at other people, even if they are props. Yuan Zheng, deputy director and a senior fellow of the Institute of American Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, said that even though gun violence is always a critical issue during the U.S. elections, they will not play a decisive role. Gun violence is a complicated issue, combining historical and partisan elements as well as social factors. The current polarized U.S. politics is making it even more difficult to solve the problem, which is actually pathetic and indicates the government's lack of capability, according to Yuan. The U.S. government's inability to address this mission impossible has laid bare the decline of U.S. governance capacity, according to a report China released in February, revealing the truth and facts of rampant U.S. gun violence. In June 2022, U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law what was reportedly the most sweeping legislation aimed at preventing gun violence in 30 years. Biden called the signing of the legislation a monumental day and said it was proof that Democrats and Republicans could find common ground on important issues. However, experts see this so-called gun deal as one that just scratches the surface, as it falls short of the essence of gun control measures expected by the public, such as prohibiting the manufacture, transfer, and possession of semi-automatic assault weapons, and the transfer and possession of large-capacity ammunition feeding devices, and a change to the age at which a person needs to be to purchase an assault-style weapon. They deemed the agreement as being just a joint political show put on by the Democrats and Republicans to trick the public and win votes during the midterm elections, amid an outcry over gun violence following the killing of at least 19 children and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, on May 24, 2022.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
I will keep thinking and worrying about idealism if there is no hope. And rationality is the steering wheel for this engine. You must think rationally, act wisely, and move forward. As for universities, I have much to say about them. You also spoke about them, and what you said is correct. The problems you mentioned exist. What I want to say is that the lack of a truly comprehensive scientific plan is a great shortcoming in our universities today. We don't know what basis is used for the distribution of students in various scientific fields of study. These scientific courses of study should be in fields that are needed in the country. They must benefit the country. How many students do we need in a certain field? These matters should be considered and work needs to be done on this. I'd like to ask the Honorable Minister of Science, he's probably among us here, to pursue this matter. It is one of the important tasks that you need to do.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are some fields of study that aren't even needed in Iran. There aren't any jobs in these fields either. Well, what's the point? There is no point in carrying out certain academic activities or attending certain academic courses. Perhaps we have several hundreds of thousands of high school graduates who are able to work in different sectors right now. But instead, we bring them into the university environment, and after a while, we turn over a few hundred thousands angry, demanding, unemployed people with a bachelor's or master's degree to the country. Let's think about what we need and take action according to our needs. If we have a university graduate who doesn't have a job, you should know that there is a problem with our educational system. If someone studies a field of study in order to be able to benefit his or her country, their job must be ready. If we have a graduate, but he does not have a job, it is clear that this student's enrollment was not done systematically based on correct calculations. Well, our time is up and there is still much to be said. I like you and I pray for you. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Experts say the freezing of Russia's forex holdings has accelerated de-dollarization around the world. IMF has recently said that the share of US dollar in global reserves has reached to its lowest level in 28 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, the process of diversifying away from the greenback by countries around the world is gathering pace according to the latest data from the International Monetary Fund. The statistics tracked by the Washington-based institution show that the dollar's share of official gold and foreign currency reserves dropped to a nearly three-decade low of 58% in the fourth quarter of 2022. The move has reportedly been gradual, and the dollar share of central banks' foreign reserves is now nearly down to a level last seen in 1995. The long-standing status of the dollar as the world's dominant currency has been steadily eroded in recent years amid concerns over soaring U.S. debt and widely implemented sanctions using the currency as leverage. The shift was more pronounced when adjusted for exchange rates, according to Stephen Jen, CEO of Eurozone SLJ Capital Limited, as quoted by Reuters. He said, "What happened in 2022 was a very sharp plummeting in the dollar share in real terms, calling the decline a reaction to the freezing of half of Russia's $640 billion in gold and FX reserves." According to Jen, the drastic step sparked a rethink in countries like Saudi Arabia, China, India, and Turkey about diversifying their reserves to other currencies. The yuan's share of global over-the-counter forex transactions has increased from nearly zero 15 years ago to 7%, according to the Bank for International Settlements, BIS. After the move against Russia, other countries are questioning, what if you fall on the wrong side of sanctions? BNY Mellon strategist Jeffrey Yu told the media. He said global central banks are currently seeking to diversify their assets, scooping up corporate debt, tangible assets such as real estate and other currencies. "This is the process that is underway," Mark Tinker, managing director of TAS Fund Hong Kong, told the agency, adding, "The dollar is going to be used less in the global system." Meanwhile, Mehr News Agency reported de-dollarization is not a voluntary choice, but it is a necessary response to the weaponization of the dollar, Iran's first vice president said recently, adding that ditching the dollar will endanger U.S. influence in the world. Addressing the 51st edition of the Asian Clearing Union ACU summit in Tehran recently, Iran's first vice president, Mohammad Mukhber, praised the intention of the ACU member states to create a new chapter of economic relations and financial and commercial interactions. A country with a size of 1.64 million square kilometers and a population of about 85 million, who are mostly young and educated people, Iran has a high capacity to attract domestic and foreign investments and take advantage of the demographic opportunities in increasing production and economic growth, Mukhbir said. Vice President Mukhbir examined the role of the dollar in the world economy and said, "De-dollarization is not a voluntary choice by countries anymore. It is the country's inevitable response to the weaponization project of the dollar. In the past decades, the weaponization of the dollar has forced countries to find a way to get rid of the impact of possible sanctions in the future," Mukhbir further asserted. Referring to the increasing number of countries that are looking to reduce their dependency on the U.S. dollar, the vice president said that the weakening of the dollar can be a serious threat to the United States' influence at the international level. Iran's first vice president went on to conclude that the Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to develop its banking and trade relations with other countries, especially ACU member states.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Chaque samedi. Bientôt 5 ans.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the Yellow Vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the Yellow Vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people.